Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about Iraq and looking particularly back to the early days of the Iraq War as we talk with a retired military officer who served there. Our guest is Peter Mansour. He currently holds the Raymond E. Mason Jr. Chair in Military History at Ohio State University. He is a highly decorated officer with more than 26 years of military service. And before going to Ohio State, he served as the executive officer to General David Petraeus, commander of multinational forces in Iraq. He was involved in helping General Petraeus with strategic planning for the war effort and also to prepare him for meetings with top leaders like the President and the Secretary of Defense and the National Security Council. Prior to his most recent deployment, he also served on a council of colonels that enabled the Joint Chiefs to reassess the strategy for the Iraq War, and based in part on discussions of that group, the U.S. began the policy that came to be known as the Surge. He's also founding director of the U.S. Army Marine Corps Counterinsurgency Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and was involved in revising the Counterinsurgency Field Manual, which was published jointly by the Army and the Marine Corps in December 2006. That was the first revision of U.S. counterinsurgency doctrine in more than 20 years. And he is also the author of a book that is about his experiences in 2003 in Iraq. As a brigade commander, the title of his book is Baghdad at Sunrise, and it is published by the Yale University Press. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and questions are certainly welcome. We'll just ask people to try and be brief so we can keep going, get as many as callers as possible. But, of course, callers are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Colonel Mansour, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And let me begin by congratulating the Mighty Illini on a great win up at the Big House this weekend.
That was pretty stunning, wasn't it?
Juice Williams is something else. Hopefully isn't that good when we come to town. But
well, that remains to be seen. Well, I certainly appreciate you talking with us. There's so much I would like to talk about. I scarcely know where to start. Maybe the question I'm interested in starting with, though, is you write in the book about going to Iraq in 2003 and the situation there that you found yourself in. Was this like anything that you had encountered in your military experience before?
It was not. In fact, I write in the book that, you know, the training that we had received to fight the Red Army in Europe, all the professional military education over a 20-plus year career was pretty thin gruel for what we experienced in Iraq. We had all but ignored counterinsurgency warfare since the end of the Vietnam War. In fact, files had been thrown away by several important groups because they assumed we would never fight a counterinsurgency war like Vietnam again because it had been so devastating to the nation. And I think as a result, we paid the price when we were faced with yet that kind of war again in 2003.
Mm-hmm. That's, I suppose, one of the central questions here, and it's a question that I'm sure that all kinds of people ask whether they thought it was a good idea to go or not. And that is the way that things were handled after the defeat of the Iraqi army. I think probably going into it, no matter whether you thought it was a good or bad idea, I don't think that anybody really doubted that the U.S. military could defeat Saddam Hussein's army. The question was, okay, after you win that, then what? That seemed to be the problem. There was not very much thought devoted to then what.
Well, it wasn't just that, but I think it was the way in which we attempted to defeat his army and did defeat his army. And that is this new concept of rapid decisive operations, these very high technology, highly mobile military forces that penetrate deep to the heart of the center of power of a nation and collapse it from within. What I think that concept, which was being bandied about in the early 2000s and is more popularly known as shock and awe, What it failed to recognize was the enduring nature of warfare, not just in the 21st century, but in any era, that it is necessary not just to defeat the armed forces of an opposing nation, but to make sure that you lay the grounds for a more enduring peace. And I don't think this happened in Iraq. We didn't secure the lines of supply. We didn't secure the major urban areas that we bypassed on the way to Baghdad. As a result, there are a number of groups in Iraq who very much resented the invasion and didn't feel that they had been defeated. And as a result, they went to ground and began a guerrilla war.
You are a military historian. I know that you have written a book about the GI and the role of the GI in World War II in Europe, a book that's very well thought of. It makes me go back to the comments about how after Vietnam, people in the military said, well, we're never going to fight a war like that again, and so we don't need to learn anything from that. I guess I'm interested in the notion that there is something, some part of war fighting that is the same, and it doesn't matter, you know, what kind of war it is, that you have to do it really no matter what kind of war you're fighting. And it sounds as if that's maybe something that we've overlooked.
Well, we became enamored with high technology, with winning wars at great distance and at little cost. And I think we failed to recognize the need for boots on the ground to stabilize a population, to ensure that government services remain up and running, and so forth. But look, you know, we might, even with all of that, we might have been successful had we not made really serious errors in that first year of the occupation, the two most important being the disbanding of the Iraqi army and the de-bathification of Iraqi society, both of which created huge numbers of disenfranchised and disillusioned groups that were then ready to oppose the new Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Well, would it? I think that some people have also said, as you pointed to, the part of the issue at the beginning was that we didn't have enough soldiers there, and that somehow if we had more, that would have made a difference. Would it have? And how many more would we be talking about? Did we even have that many?
Well, it would have made a difference. We needed more soldiers, but more importantly, we needed to incorporate Iraqi soldiers into the stability operations that we were conducting. I believe had we gone in with a more robust force, something on the order of what General Eric Shinseki called for in his testimony to Congress in February of 2003, where he said, in my experience, which was based on the Balkans, given a country the size of Iraq and with the population of Iraq, it'll take somewhere on the order of several hundred thousand troops to stabilize the country following an invasion. He was right. Had we provided those forces and then backed them up with a restored Iraqi army, you know, the Iraqi army, according to Jerry Bremer, Ambassador Jerry Bremer, self-demobilized. Well, that's true, but they also could have been called back to the colors. Jobs were scarce, and I think that most Iraqis would agree that the soldiers would have come back. You could have lopped off the very top leadership, which is highly Ba'athist and ruthless in its nature, but you could have put them under new management. And then you would have had several hundred thousand Iraqi soldiers as well. And the combination of a more robust coalition and a restored Iraqi army, I think, would have nipped the insurgency in the bud and prevented what we saw, almost tear Iraq apart in 2006 with the horrific sectarian violence.
It's pretty clear you think that Paul Bremer did a bad job.
I think he did a horrible job.
Why do you think that he was simply not suited to the job? Was it, did it have something to do with expectations that were placed on him by the Department of Defense or by the White House? Or was it just a whole series of flawed assumptions about what things were like and how things would work? I guess I'm interested in what you really think the big problem was.
You know, I don't know what the problem is in terms of his background or his preparation for the job. I can only assess, you know, what he did when he got into the job. He acted like a viceroy in a nation that had just undergone 30 years of trauma under a very brutal dictator. And I think what he needed to be doing was to reach out to a lot of disaffected groups in Iraqi society and build stakeholders at the local level and build this new Iraq from the ground up. I think what he did was he tried to dictate things from the top. It was a way of doing business that the Iraqis, quite frankly, had seen before, and many of them resented it. And then, moreover, the people he chose to be his partners in that business in the Iraqi Governing Council were highly sectarian politicians. Many of them had been brought in from exile outside the country, and they were resented by the power brokers inside Iraq who had stayed in the country and had undergone the repression of Saddam Hussein. So I think for a variety of reasons, he approached the job wrong in terms of style and substance, and he got the politics wrong, which is the greatest damage of all.
Well, I'll ask you one more question myself here, and I have a couple callers we'll get to. I think that there are some people looking at this whole experience and would say something like, you know, the part of the problem here is that armies are trained to fight wars, not so much to do social engineering, but that in fact was the role that you and other soldiers like you found yourself in. So the question is, well, can this be, should this be a mission for the military? And if you say the answer is, well, yes, it can and should, then how do you incorporate that into the training that soldiers get when they're being trained how to fight and win wars?
Yeah, that's a big topic. We could spend an hour just on that question alone. I don't think we're going to have any choice but to engage in these kind of stability operations in this century. We don't face a near-peer competitor as a nation for a while, until a rising China, maybe about the middle part of the century, becomes equivalent to us in terms of economic strength, although given the stock market today, who knows. But what we're going to face is a lot of areas of instability that can generate problems for the world system on a variety of levels, terrorism being one of them. And to stabilize these areas of the world, sometimes it's going to be necessary for U.S. forces to be involved. We have two wars that we have to fight and bring to a successful conclusion, however you want to define that. I've got my own definitions, but we can talk about that with the listeners. There is more to come. I mean, you look at Pakistan, it's not looking too good. There are a variety of other nations that are on the edge in terms of their government stability. And the United States military is the most capable force our nation has to stabilize these kind of situations. Now, in Baghdad at sunrise, I call for a revamped civilian capacity to assist in these kind of operations. USAID, the United States Agency for International Development, for instance, is a shadow of what it used to be during the Vietnam conflict and the Cold War. It's one example of where resources can be applied in order to generate the kind of capability our nation needs to fight and win these kind of wars, should we choose to be engaged in them. And that's actually another, you know, discussion topic that we can talk about. But the military already is adapting. We have a new counterinsurgency manual, as you said up front. We are training and educating our officers, non-commissioned officers, and soldiers for counterinsurgency and stability operations in the schools around the nation and in the training centers. And the Army has created stability operations doctrine as well. So, and the Marine Corps has had it for a long time. So I think the answer is yes. We're going to have to be involved, and we're going to have to create those kind of capabilities in the armed forces, and we can't just sort of wash our hands of it and say, well, all we do is windows, and therefore we're not going to worry about the rest of the building, being torn down while we wash the windows.
Let me introduce again our guest, and we'll start talking with some people who are listening. Our guest, Peter Mansour, holds the Raymond Mason Jr. Chair in Military History at The Ohio State University. Before that, he served as Executive Officer to General David Petraeus, Commander of Multinational Forces in Iraq. He was also a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Strategy Group that proposed the Surge strategy in Iraq. He's a founding director of the U.S. Army Marine Corps Counterinsurgency Center. He was also commander of the 1st Brigade Combat Team, 1st Armored Division in Baghdad, 2003-2004, and writes about that experience in his book Baghdad at Sunrise, A Brigade Commander's War in Iraq. It's published by the Yale University Press. And we have some callers here to talk with. We'll start right in. First off, with someone in Savoy, a nearby community, line one. Hello.
Hello. I came in, I'd say maybe 5, maybe 6 minutes late here. I hope my question's not too redundant. First, let me get an orientation question here. You were XO to General Petraeus when he had how many stars?
I was his executive officer from the time he took command of Multinational Force Iraq in February 2007 until I left Iraq 15 months later in May of 2008. So I was with him from the time he pinned on his 4th star and then for 15 months.
Okay. If you would tolerate a curiosity question, what was your rank during that time?
I was a full colonel.
Full colonel. Okay, bird colonel. All right, thank you. Now, my question is basically about two things. And I can halfway guess part of the answer from what I've heard while I was on the phone, but let me be clear with the questions. Do you believe you know who, I don't care whether it was one person or five or ten, do you know who was behind the debathification idea, and who is behind the disbanding the Iraqi army idea?
I believe that you can lay both of those issues on the doorstep of Ambassador Jerry Bremer. He claims in his memoirs that he ran the idea back to Washington, and his at the time his higher headquarters was in the Department of Defense, but if you look at what was going on in the Department of Defense at the time, there was very little thought or arguments or discussion given to the ideas of debathifying Iraqi society or disbanding the Iraqi army. Almost, I think the feeling was the war was won. We were going to get out in pretty short order, and that anything we did at that point was on the margins. And so the idea was Ambassador Bremer's. I don't think he can argue that it was anyone else's. And I think the deal was this: no one objected to it. There was not a lot of brain power applied to what this would mean for Iraq as a society and going into the future.
Apparently so. What month and year did he come in country?
He came in May of 2003, right after the mission accomplished banner was...
Oh, he came in that soon, because I remember there was a retired general that was sort of trying to piece things together very early.
That was Jay Garner.
Yes, Garner. Yes. Did he want to go, or did he get eased out?
Jay Garner was very surprised that he had been relieved of his position, and he didn't want to go. I think, in retrospect, as historians are looking more and more at the early days, they're discovering that actually Jay Garner was doing a better job than anyone had supposed at the time. The problem at its core was we didn't start planning for post-occupation or post-invasion Iraq soon enough. We started maybe a couple months before the invasion began. By comparison, General George C. Marshall, the Army Chief of Staff in World War II, started planning for the occupation of Germany in January of 1942, 1 month after Pearl Harbor.
Yes. Do you know, I thought I read somewhere that there was some offer, I think it's higher up the chain of thoughts than propaganda, but I think there was some offer to the Iraqi army that if they laid down their arms and looked like something other than soldiers, they would be sort of home free. Is that something I just picked up wrong, or did you ever hear anything?
No, that's correct. There were leaflets dropped. There were overtures made to Iraqi generals, basically to the irregular army, the regular Iraqi army, not to the Republican Guard or the Special Republican Guard or any of the more ruthless elements of Ba'athist power. But the regular Iraqi army was told, if you just lay down your arms, we won't kill you, we won't harm you, and you can then be part of.
Was that the result? Was part of the result of that these TV people showing me all these number of people, young men, walking along the roads without shoes, without boots? Was that part of the sign they were supposed to show, or did they just do that on their own?
No, I think that's probably just how they were clothed. But,
then maybe they didn't have boots to begin with.
Yeah, but it was disingenuous that we did this, and then we ended up disbanding the entire structure, which put hundreds of thousands of Iraqis on the street.
Absolutely the crudest form of PR, if you can even call it PR. All right. It's been very good listening to you. Do you have any idea about what month and what year people at Rummy's level began to realize this wasn't working well?
At Central Command, General John Abizade, in July of 2003, admitted that we were in a guerrilla war. But as late as that fall, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld still claimed we were up against a bunch of dead-enders.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the month and year on that.
July of 2003, General John Abizade, head of Central Command, says we're in a classic guerrilla war. But that fall, several months later, you still hear Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld claiming that all we are up against is a bunch of dead enders, when it was clear to us on the ground, as I state in Baghdad at sunrise, that the insurgency was growing in strength, force, and organization. So I think there was, basically the administration stuck its head in the sand and believed what it wanted to believe rather than taking a clear-eyed assessment of the strategic conditions in Iraq.
Well, thank the caller. I have a couple of others here I want to go on to, and we'll talk next with someone in Urbana on our line number two. Hello.
Yeah, David, thanks for the show. Mm-hmm. And it's, a massively important topic, and, some of the things that your guests have said are really chilling to me. I'll admit to being left of center and a pacifist before I get started here. But it seems to me the thing that we continue to do, the mistake that we continue to repeat, and that, with all due respect, the gentleman on the phone continues to repeat, is that we forget our own revolution. We forget that the era where armies lined up across battlefields with weapons of destruction, it really ended probably with the Civil War in the United States, but certainly we don't have the reality of the fact that we defeated the British with, these kind of hit-and-run insurgent campaigns. And so to hear discussions about, what the bigwigs on our domestic or our military side were thinking about in the run-up to this really just increases my confidence that we cannot win these wars. And if we engage them, we will be defeated routinely. And so I guess I'd like just to hear a quick response to that. Your guest made a statement, we didn't get the politics right. Well, we can never get the politics right, regardless of what kind of surveillance or embedding we have in terms of intelligence on the ground. I really appreciate the tenor of the conversation so far, and I hope the guest takes this in the spirit of polite criticism, and have a good afternoon.
All right. Well, thank you. Will you respond to that any way you like?
Well, sure. On a couple of levels. One, I don't confuse my discussion of how we waged the war with my thoughts on whether the war was justified and whether we should have engaged in it. In fact, I was on the Tavis Smiley show last week, and he showed me a clip of Senator Obama in the first debate saying, we need to go back to the reasons why we went to war in the first place and realize how serious a mistake this was. And then he showed a clip of Senator McCain saying, well, what I've learned from the Iraq war is we can't win it with a flawed strategy. And Tavis then looked at me and said, okay, who's right? And I said, well, they both are. The Iraq war was a strategic error of the first order. We had a successful strategy to contain Iraq and Iran that was in place, and we didn't need to wage a war of choice in order to topple the Ba'athist regime, no matter how brutal it was to its own people. And let me get this straight. I'm no fan of Saddam Hussein, and I certainly don't lament his passing, but I'm not sure that it was in our national interest to wage a war to topple him from power. And, you know, so having said that, I want to talk about the war itself. And that is, you know, as a military officer, you know, we're not the ones that make the policy of for the nation. It's our politicians who do, civilians. And that's, you know, by the Constitution. And we're given a tough mission, and we have to do the best we can with the resources we're given to accomplish the mission, or we need to tell the policymakers the risk that they are assuming if they don't give us the right resources or if the mission itself is flawed. And I think that's the kind of give and take that needs to go on between the military and the civilian policymakers. Final thing, the caller mentioned something about we haven't lined up toe-to-toe and gone at warfare since the Civil War. I would beg to differ. I think World War I, World War II, Korea, Gulf War all show that conventional war is not a thing of the past, and I think we can expect more warfare in the future. If mankind's history suggests anything, it's that warfare is an endemic part of human society.
I think it sounded to me like, though, what he was saying was that in the future, these kinds of wars, wars like Iraq, where we're dealing with insurgency and we're doing it in urban areas and we're not doing it out on a nice, flat, open plain where there are no noncombatants in the way or we don't have to sort between who the enemy is and you know, that kind of thing, that he was saying that we should expect that we'll be fighting more wars like that, and that he, at the very least, you would say they're very difficult to win. And it sounded from what I was saying is that he was saying, well, you know, you really can't win a war like that.
I agree with the first part. I think that's what we can expect. In fact, I say that in the final chapter in Baghdad at Sunrise. But I would disagree with the conclusion that we can just wash our hands of it and say, well, since we don't believe we can win them, then we shouldn't engage in them. For one thing, it's really not up to us to win or lose these kind of wars. It's up to usually the local government. And what counterinsurgencies entail is a support for the legitimate state institutions. And what we need to do as a nation is decide who are the states that we want to support. What are those legitimate governments that deserve our support as a nation? And that's a tough political question that we have to answer. But once we decide to go in and support a legitimate government, then there's a whole bunch of counterinsurgency tools that we've developed and are historically grounded that I think can make us successful in these kind of wars in the future.
All right, let's talk with another caller here, Champaign County, line 3. Hello.
Apropos your line of reasoning right there, I wanted to point out that a previous guest on this channel was from the RAND Corporation, actually went on to write a piece that suggests that it's not possible to win in Afghanistan using military means. Quite an interesting thing in itself. But I wanted to ask about something that's rather difficult. It's difficult in any of the many people's lives that's affected, and that's the suicide in Iraq. But I'm wanting to ask particularly about the case of, was he a Lieutenant Colonel West Hoosing? He wrote a very angry suicide note decrying the policy. I think you might have been there at the time. I'm not absolutely sure on that, but there was, most people probably don't know about it because it was not much reported. I think there is a story there that we should have already heard of. I know it's partially because it's such a delicate thing to talk about to begin with. What do you think happened
with this particular case?
Yeah, were you there when he was an aide to Matreus?
I'm not familiar with this case at all. Certainly, there were no aides to General Petraeus that I know of who committed suicide.
Well, his name is spelled West, H-U-S-I-N-G. He was from Tulsa, Oklahoma. There was a recent Texas Observer article by a guy named Bryce, B-R-Y-C-E, and you can Google West Hoosing. I am thinking that you must have come in after he left, but I'm sure if you want to find out about it, I can't believe it's hard for me to fathom that there wasn't some discussion about it. He wrote a memo, a new suicide note that decried what he was involved with in Iraq at the time.
What did the note say?
Well, I don't have it right at hand. I have some quotes from it. He's talking about how it was greedy and corrupt, and he laid it at the plate of Dr. Petraeus, which is... if that's a credible source or not, because like I say, it's just something that stuck in my mind, and the fact that there was no discussion of it after the fact when you joined, I mean, he was on rather early on. He's described as a philosopher and ethicist, and in the, I've never heard of that really being something that the military brings along. They bring along this isn't productive, but I guess I could ask listeners to investigate this if they if they're in any way intrigued.
And how do you spell his last name again?
It's Westhusing. He's an army. He was an army colonel, Ted Westhusing. He's from Oklahoma. He talked about the corruption and the lies, and then he shot himself in the head. So I'm sorry, I can't. And there are, he was, for the longest time, he was the highest ranking suicide in Iraq. He was a colonel.
Interesting.
In Petraeus's. So.
Well, he was in General Petraeus's command, no doubt, but I don't think he was very close to the general. I know all the aides that are real close to the general. I doubt that he was on his personal staff, but...
he was.
Well, being on the staff and being on his personal staff are two different things. But anyway, let me address the topic of suicides in Iraq in general, though, because it is a concern to the command there, and there is a great deal of effort given to making sure that soldiers have the right kind of psychological help that they need. And it's not just in this case, but... post-traumatic stress disorder is a serious issue that the command takes very seriously, and psychologists are part and parcel of the military medical care community over there to help soldiers work through this. Having said that, when you have 140,000 plus troops and they all have weapons and access to ammunition 24/7, there's going to be some suicides that you can't prevent. And you know, you try to, each one is a tragedy, and you try to do what you can to help soldiers work through it and to make sure that they get the care they need. But regrettably, some happen.
This apparently happened in June, early June of 2005.
Oh, okay, June of 2005.
So, and I think at that, you weren't there at that time, I don't think.
No, I was not.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry that we can't go any further than that with the caller. I do have some others and want to move on. Let me reintroduce the guest for this part of Focus 580, Peter Mansour. He's now a teaching military history at Ohio State University. He's a recently retired U.S. Army colonel. He served as executive officer to General David Petraeus. He was the commanding officer of the multinational force in Iraq. That was 2007-2008. He was a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Strategy Group that proposed the surge. That was 2007. A founding director of the U.S. Army Marine Corps Counterinsurgency Center. Also was served as commander of the 1st Brigade Combat Team, 1st Armored Division in Baghdad, 2003-2004. And he writes about the experience in his book, Baghdad at Sunrise, A Brigade Commander's War in Iraq. The book is published by the Yale University Press. We do indeed have some other callers here, and I think next in line is someone in Naperville on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello?
Good morning.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, this subject about war, everybody hates it, and I have neighbors that have gone over there to Iraq and back, And my hats are off to you and everybody out there. Regardless of how we feel about it, I think they're doing a heck of a job. We have the best fighting forces in the world, by none. And I think far enough, you know, to me, when people call in and start complaining about the war, and it is a war, and wars are not good, but, you know, God help forbid us, you know, God help us if we ever get in a war where they actually come in and do something to this country like World War II did to, you know, what the Germans did to France and England and all the rest of the surrounding countries, because I don't think this country could stomach it. And I don't know how you feel about this, but I've gotten this, you know, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, and they have sons and daughters that are in this war, and don't think it's the right thing. I think all we hear is the negative aspect and not the positive aspect. And I was wondering how you feel about that.
Well, I think you're right on the mark when you talk about the quality of the American soldier. Without a doubt, we have the finest army in the world by a long margin. And this generation is really stepping up to the plate. Tom Brokaw came over to Iraq, and he said, you know, looking around, I see before me the newest, greatest generation. And a lot of people like to decry our youth and, you know, how soft they are, but yet they keep volunteering, and they transform into soldiers and Marines and airmen and sailors, and they continue to do extraordinary things in some very difficult circumstances overseas, not just in Iraq, but Afghanistan and elsewhere. So I would agree with you on that. And, you know, in Baghdad at Sunrise, I talk about, in the very end of the book, I talk about a story when I was in New York, and I was invited to a cocktail party on the Upper East Side of the city. And the hostess's son, I found out, was really interested in military things. And so, you know, he was like in high school at the time, maybe a freshman. And so I was talking to him about the Army and about military history. And then I looked at him, I said, you know, you're really interested in the military. You know, West Point's just about 25 miles upriver. Why don't you, you should consider going, you know, take a visit and see if you like it. And the hostess blanched, her face went white. You would have thought that I had sentenced him to death. And she put his arm around him and then said, no. He has much more important things to do in his life. And then she patted me, and at this, I was in uniform, actually. She patted me, and she said, but I'm happy we have you people to protect us. And I would submit that if that kind of attitude persists among the elites of our nation, that we are in serious trouble. As a nation, because I don't think through history you can ever find a nation or a state that was able to exist for long if its fighting was done by a very small percentage of the population and the ethic of government or public service languished among the elites. So, you know, I would agree with the caller in that regard as well.
All right, let's talk with someone else here. I'll go to Chicago for another caller. This is line 3.
Thank you.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could try to respond to the statement by former Secretary of State Baker, and we also had a subsequent Baker-Hamilton report. Well, he stated on the Terry Gross Show on National Public Radio, he had stated, we have a foreign policy that states we will go to war in order to maintain our access to oil. And could you respond to a statement like that, considering what that portrays for our future?
Well, I think that oil is what fuels the world economy. And if somehow access to oil in large measure were cut off, that our national survival would be imperiled at that point. So I can see where he's coming from. But I think there's another part to it, and that is going forward in Iraq. What does stability in Iraq mean for the world oil markets? And this is one of the four really key national security issues at stake in Iraq going forward. One is containing Iran, make sure that Iran doesn't expand its hegemony in the region. A second one would be to prevent a terrorist safe haven from developing in Iraq, which I think we're well on our way to achieving that goal. A third one is to prevent a further humanitarian catastrophe with refugee flows across the borders in excess of the 2 million that have already left Iraq. And then the fourth one is access to energy resources. And if you have a situation in Iraq where the state is unstable, where you have unchecked refugee flows across the borders into Saudi Arabia and Jordan and Syria and Kuwait and Iran, and what you'll find is that the world oil markets will price in a large measure of risk into every barrel of oil coming out of the Gulf, and that will put our economy into further jeopardy. So it works on a number of levels, and I can see where he's coming from, and oil is certainly a vital national interest for the United States.
Well, just real quick, to put a direct question, you know that there are people who think that the need to protect our access to oil was the reason that we undertook this war, and that was essentially the only reason. And the other things that have been given as reasons were either less important, maybe not important at all. There are people who say it was all about oil, beginning and ending, and that's it.
Yeah, I would disagree. In fact, I do disagree in Baghdad at sunrise with that charge. I think if we had wanted oil, we would have lifted the sanctions on Iraq. We would have told Saddam Hussein he can treat his people any way he wants as long as he sells lots of oil on the world market. And I think Saddam Hussein would have been more than willing to do that. I think what caused us to go into Iraq, when you get down to it, is fear. 2,000 years ago, the Athenian historian Thucydides said nations go to war for one of three reasons: fear, honor, and interest. Oil would have been interest. But I think that in the wake of 9/11, this nation was deeply fearful and thus was receptive to a president that invoked visions of mushroom clouds over American cities to draw us into a war that he wanted to wage in Iraq.
We have about 10 minutes left. We have some other callers. I'd like to try to get some more folks in here, and we'll go next to Urbana and line number two. Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. A while back, you said that we could win against an insurgency so long as we were backing a legitimate government. We did not go into Iraq to back a legitimate government, and it's hard to see how the Iraqi people would accept any puppet government we set up as legitimate. Therefore, I think the situation is much different from what you picture. I would also point out that we did go into Vietnam to support a government, legitimate or not, and we were unable to win that war.
Well, you can comment on that any way you like.
Well, I'll leave Vietnam aside for the moment and tackle Iraq, which is a big enough problem to tackle. The Iraqi government, I would agree with you, Initially, the government we put into place, the Iraqi Governing Council, followed by the interim Iraqi government, were, to all extents and purposes, puppet regimes without a lot of backing from the Iraqi people as a whole, and I don't think we could have expected them to survive without massive amounts of U.S. force backing them up. In Baghdad at sunrise, I argue that we should have tried to create stakeholders at the local level and work the creation of a new Iraqi government from the bottom up. That is, first create district neighborhood councils, district councils, city councils, eventually working up to provincial councils, and end the process with a nationwide referendum on a constitution and then national elections. We reversed that process, and by doing so, we created a government that didn't have a great deal of backing among the Iraqi people and set the seeds for the rending of Iraqi society, which occurred during the horrific sectarian violence of 2006. I still think that it's possible going ahead that Iraq could come out okay. But its government has got to choose to be a government for all Iraqis, and it has to create a representative system in which all different groups in Iraq feel they have a stake in the political process. That's why the provincial elections law that was just passed is so important, because the Sunni majority didn't participate in the last set of provincial elections, and they said they will this time. And that's vitally important if they're to be brought into the political process rather than staying on the outside trying to tear down the government with insurgent violence. So what will become of Iraq remains to be seen, but it will be up to the Iraqis to sort it out, and it will be okay as long as they're able to move the competition for power and resources into the political realm going forward.
How much longer do you think that substantial numbers of American soldiers will be in Iraq?
Years. Now, that is unless a President Obama decides to pull them out in 16 months. But if we want to stabilize Iraq, it will take a number of years to do so. Not decades, as some people claim, but months is too soon. The way to stabilize Iraq is to continue to nudge its political process forward with all the levers that we can muster, to continue to build its army and its police force into a non-sectarian institution, and then to slowly turn over responsibility for security to those forces and allow the Iraqi government to govern. The problem with withdrawing too fast is it's likely that the different groups in Iraq will merely then retrench and bide their time until the withdrawal is complete, and then it could very well devolve back into civil war. I think we could avoid that if we space the withdrawal out over a longer period of time while creating viable Iraqi institutions in the meantime. And that, you know, that'll take years, so somewhere between 2 and 9, probably somewhere closer to the 9.
And you don't think that there would be people in Iraq who would be patient enough to say, okay, so the United States doesn't leave next year, they don't leave the year after that. One of these days they're going to leave, and then we take up the fight again. I guess I'm not – are you really confident that enough stability could be achieved so that whenever that day comes when the U.S. troops leave, we don't immediately end up with a civil war again?
Actually, I am confident that we could achieve that stability. What we saw at the end of 2006 was a nation that was almost engaged in full-scale civil war and a nation that was coming apart. In just 18 months, we've completely turned that situation around and have brought many former insurgents and militia members into the political process. The kind of progress we've seen has been fairly amazing in a short period of time. I don't know that we can expect that kind of pace of change to continue. It may slow down as politics rear its ugly head, but the progress is continuing, and I really do think that given our continued support, we can see a stable Iraq emerge from what it is today. And this does not mean that, by the way, that our forces are going to be engaged in nonstop combat for that entire period. More and more, we're going to be transitioning our role into advising a more capable Iraqi army and helping create viable government institutions.
We'd like to try and get at least one more caller in here, so we'll go to the next in line. That's someone in the community of Belgium nearby, line one. Hello?
Yes, I'm going to try to ask quickly a question that he will not be able to answer. Given the situation with Mr. Rumsfeld, Mr. Cheney, Mr. Bush's attitudes at the beginning of this war and such a drumbeat to go to war, what kind of paradigm shift would it take for the military to say, wait a minute, that's our lives we're dealing with, and you're not going there for the right reasons, and you're not going there with the right planning and the right situation? There has to be some sort of way that the military, without being, you know, traitors, say, wait a minute, you guys aren't right.
Actually, I think that was the responsibility of the American people to, through their elected representatives in Congress, to put pressure on the administration. It would be, we don't want to go down the road of the military dictating to the administration that the reasons for its political actions are wrong. That is one short step away from a coup. On the other hand, I would say that the military does have a role in planning. And if they feel that the amount of troops or the plan that the administration wants to put into effect for a military action is inappropriate or carries too much risk, they have not just the right but a duty and an obligation to say so. And I think in that latter sense, we had military leaders who either just kept quiet or were not, I think, educated and trained well enough for their level of responsibility, because it was quite clear, I think, to me that the planning was pretty thin, and the amount of resources being applied on the ground was inappropriate for the level of effort and the objectives that were planned.
So we're almost out of time, but this is a question that I had in my mind as well. It doesn't frustrate you that we do have this basic principle that says if you're in uniform, you don't make political statements?
It doesn't frustrate me at all. I thank God every day that our Constitution says that. I've seen way too many nations around the world where the military does get involved, and then you end up with a Pakistan or a Turkey or other nations where the military steps in when they feel that the national interest is not being carried out by the civilian government. I would not like to see the United States go down that road. So much better that we go through the pain of this war than see our nation go down the road of military intervention in the political system.
Well, there, we're going to have to leave it. My apologies. We have some callers we can't take. Our guest, Peter Mansour, teaches military history at Ohio State. He's a recently retired U.S. Army colonel. He served as the executive officer to Commanding General David Petraeus of the multinational force in Iraq. He was also commander of the 1st Brigade Combat Team, 1st Armored Division in Baghdad 2003 and 4, and writes about that experience in his book, Baghdad at Sunrise, A Brigade Commander's War in Iraq. It's published by the Yale University Press. And Colonel Mansour, thanks very much.
Well, thank you for having me on.